This is State Department release documents where Hillary Clinton said it will be a massive boon to Israeli security if we can remove Bashar al-Assad. She said that in April 2012. This is the elephant in the room. As long as Obama and his policymakers favor the objectives and interests of Israel, there's no way out of this quagmire.
What are we collectively as African Americans, as people of color, what are we doing about it? I ask that question again. Other than expressing our outrage, what are we collectively as a community doing about the systemic, economic, political, and social inequality that confronts people of color and the economically disadvantaged in this country?
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avarum. On the Ground is your D.C.-based show covering activists and activism for social justice in a media world that seems to cover everything else but what really matters to the people. So we're here on Fridays, and we're here for you. Today, I'll focus on the state of never-ending war and the war of words by the United States since 9/11. The United States and its allies have bombed or are bombing at least 8 countries in the Middle East and Africa. In Syria, where this country is holding on to the policy of regime change of another Arab leader, we are trading charges of violence against civilians and war crimes with Russia. Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the war hawks surrounding her continue to call for a no-fly zone. That is a no-fly zone of planes other than U.S. planes. Meantime, the same U.S. charges against Russia for harm to civilians is not being applied to casualties caused by U.S. bombs in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, or elsewhere. We'll be speaking to Ray McGovern, former CIA officer turned political activist, and also to Michael McPherson, an Army veteran and executive director of Veterans for Peace. So as always, we have a lot packed into our little hour, our less than an hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. Hundreds of soldiers and riot police used pepper spray, sirens, beanbags, and tasers against protesters protesting against the controversial North Dakota oil pipeline on Thursday. Police in riot gear removed the demonstrators using trucks, military Humvees, buses, 2 helicopters, and an airplane. The protesters, including Native Americans and environmental activists, have been camped out on private property since Sunday near the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline near the town of Cannonball. The pipeline would run within a half mile of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Opponents say the project will adversely impact drinking water and would disturb sacred burial sites. Hundreds of protesters from Standing Rock and other tribes have set up camp in a protest a few miles away from where Thursday's confrontation occurred. On Wednesday, the Reverend Jesse Jackson joined Mark Ruffalo, the actor, in support of the protests.
Yes, I am.
I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I am.
I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I am.
I am.
Somebody.
Respect me.
Protect me.
Protect me.
Never neglect me.
Never neglect me.
I am.
I am.
God's child.
God's child.
My mind.
My mind.
My mind.
My mind.
Is a pearl.
Is a pearl.
I can learn anything.
I can learn anything.
In the world.
In the world.
If my mind.
If my mind.
Can conceive it.
Can conceive it.
In my heart.
In my heart.
Can believe it.
Can believe it.
I know.
I know.
I can achieve it.
I can achieve it.
Keep hope.
Keep hope.
Alive.
Alive.
Keep hope.
Keep hope.
Alive.
Alive.
Year round.
Year round.
Keep hope.
Keep hope.
Alive.
Alive.
Standing.
Standing.
Standing rock.
Standing rock.
Sioux Nation.
With the Sioux Nation.
Standing rock.
Standing rock.
Iowa, Dakota.
Yeah. Thursday's incident came less than a week after more than 80 people were arrested, including journalist Dia Schlossberg, producer for environmentalist filmmaker Josh Fox, was charged on Saturday with 3 felonies for recording the protests. Here in D.C., dozens of protesters rallied Wednesday outside the official ribbon cutting for Donald Trump's new luxury hotel, the Trump International Hotel Old Post Office, in addition to drawing those opposing Trump's rhetoric about Muslims, immigrants, Hispanics, and women. The protests drew workers affiliated with Unite Here, a union representing those working in the hotel and hospitality industries. Trump has refused to negotiate with workers who voted to form a union at a Las Vegas hotel he owns. Labor organizers Joshua Ramseed and Jocelyn Williams told reporters that they were demonstrating against Trump's unfair labor practices.
Until he negotiates with his workers in Las Vegas, we're going to picket every establishment he has, every partner he has business with. We at Unite Here and our allies will be there to picket and protest. No justice, no peace.
Donald Trump is an anti-worker employer. He hires people, does not pay them well, and abuses them. And this is America, and this is not what America stands for.
Two protesters also carried a large American flag scrawled with the misogynist remarks made by Trump. Also in D.C., local Black Lives Matter activists are preparing to mark the one-year anniversary of the death of Alonzo Smith at the hands of so-called special police officers at an apartment complex in Southeast D.C. Marking the anniversary, there will be a candlelight vigil this Tuesday, November 1st, from 7 to 9 p.m. in front of the Marbury Plaza Apartments, 2300 Good Hope Road Southeast here in Washington, D.C. Beverly Smith, mother of Alonzo Smith, was told by the U.S. Attorney's Office that there would be no indictments in the case. After the meeting, she vowed to reporters and supporters to press forward, pursuing identification and criminal prosecution of the officers involved in Alonzo's death.
Fight is not over.
No, it's not.
It is not.
No, it's not.
Not discouraged, okay? I'm not even concerned about the silver case, about the money. That's what she mentioned. I'm not concerned about that. What I am concerned about is having these two special police officers indicted for the murder of my son.
Yeah.
And they will.
Yes.
Until
yes.
My last breath. Okay, I'm going to fight for the justice for my son. They still do not want to release the name, but it's okay. Because, guarantee this, I will have the full names of both of them within a month, and I will release them to the press. I promise you that.
In other Black Lives Matter news, the New York Times reported this week that the Justice Department has replaced the New York team of agents and lawyers investigating the death of Eric Garner. According to sources, the case had been slowed by a dispute because federal prosecutors and the Federal Bureau of Investigation officials in New York opposed bringing charges, while prosecutors with the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. argued that there was clear evidence to do so. Garner died in 2014 on a Staten Island street corner where police officer Daniel Pantaleo was seen on video using a chokehold prohibited by the New York Police Department. Then Pantaleo and other officers and paramedics stood by as Garner laid on the ground. Garner's last words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry for protesters around the country. Such issues affecting the Black community were the subject of the annual State of Black Leadership Program Tuesday night, where Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby spoke at the University of Maryland. Chantel James has more.
Participants got dressed up in their finest attire for an event at the University of Maryland College Park titled The State of Black Leadership. Sponsored by the campus chapter of the NAACP, the event was held in the Adele H. Stamp Student Union on October 25th. After a dance performance, keynote speaker Marilyn J. Mosby took the mic. Afterwards, there was a panel discussion about issues as diverse as the role of social media and the role of feminism in the Black Lives Matter movement. Here, keynote speaker Marilyn Mosby issues a call to action.
When you are a young Black man living in the city of Baltimore, you are an endangered species. When within 1 year, there were over 344 homicides, 302 of those individuals killed in the streets of Baltimore were young Black men. when the unemployment rate for young black men between 20 and 24 is more than twice as high than that of whites, when you grow up in an impoverished community where there are over 18,000 vacant houses, 16,000 vacant lots, where 24% of Baltimore's population is living in poverty, and 35% of children are living below poverty, then when you are stopped, searched, and even strip searched in public or arrested unconstitutionally on a recurrent basis, when you have been routinely dehumanized by the very people who are sworn to protect and serve you, it's easy to become outraged. As young, educated, conscious African Americans and people of color, not just in Baltimore but in this country, we should all be outraged by what we're seeing all across and all over social media. As African Americans watching, and as Americans watching fathers and sons and husbands and brothers targeted, brutalized, and killed based on the color of their skin, you should all be outraged. But my question to you tonight is, what are we doing about it? What are we collectively as African Americans, as people of color, what are we doing about it? I ask that question again. Other than expressing our outrage, what are we collectively as a community doing about the systemic, economic, political, and social inequality that confronts people of color and the economically disadvantaged in this country? History has proven we can't continue to just march and protest and think that things will get better on their own. It's time for us to truly understand that the awesome power of now, the awesome power of unity, the awesome power of young people realizing that you have to be the driving force for social justice reform. And it starts when we, as young people, have a seat at the table.
For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
In Planet News, the World Wildlife Fund has issued a report saying that two-thirds of the world's wildlife could be extinct by 2020. Since 1970, there has already been a 58% decline in the numbers of fish, mammals, birds, and reptiles worldwide, according to the fund's latest biannual Living Planet Index. The fund says that the extinction is part of a sixth mass extinction on Earth caused by human-fueled climate change. And finally, issues of police brutality, violence, and race are also highlighted through arts and activism for this fourth Friday. Freeze Frame, Stop the Madness, a performance by impresario Debbie Allen on stage at the Kennedy Center through this Sunday. Freeze Frame fuses movement, music, art, and cinema to explore violence and race relations. It features Broadway performers, young hip-hop artists, and Debbie Allen Dance Academy's finest, along with original music by Stevie Wonder, James Ingram, Arturo Sandoval, and Ricky Minor. In theaters, Inferno, the latest in the series that started with The Da Vinci Code, opens, starring Tom Hanks, and The Best Democracy That Money Can Buy, Greg Palast's movie about the real rigged elections against people of color especially, opens today for a one-week run at the pop-up Angelica Theater at Union Market in Northeast D.C. In visual arts, there will be a reception this Sunday at 5 p.m. marking the opening of Migration 61 in honor of Jacob Lawrence's Migration series at the Busboys and Poets Brookland location in D.C. And apparently the hot and impossible ticket to get is to Taste of Black D.C. Saturday at 6 p.m. at the University of District Law School. Guests will taste dishes from various Black-owned D.C. restaurants and chefs while enjoying music from local bands and artists. And those are headlines and happenings. Now, when we come back, the latest in war after more than 15 years of war since 9/11. Stay with us. That was End of the Line by Fotek on the Ground, ontheground.org. I'm Esther Averam, and today my focus is on the state of never-ending war and the war of words by the United States since 9/11. The United States and its allies have bombed or are bombing at least 8 countries in the Middle East and in Africa, in Syria, where this country is holding on to a policy of regime change of another Arab leader. We are trading charges of violence against civilians and war crimes with Russia. Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the war hawks surrounding her continue to call for a no-fly zone. And that seems to be a no-fly zone for planes other than U.S. planes. Meantime, the same U.S. charges against Russia for harm to civilians is not being applied to casualties caused by the U.S. in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and in other places. With me in studio is Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst turned political activist. McGovern was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990, and in the 1980s chaired the National Intelligence Estimates and prepared the President's Daily Brief. He received the Intelligence Commendation Medal at his retirement, returning it in 2006 to protest the CIA's involvement in torture. McGovern's post-retirement work includes commentating on intelligence issues and in 2003 co-founding Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Esther.
Also joining me is Michael McPherson, an Army veteran from the first Gulf War and Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Mr. McPherson spoke earlier this year at the Breaking Through Power conference here in D.C. He joins us from St. Louis. Good morning, Michael.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to both of you. Thank you for joining me. Well, Ray, I want you to first comment on some of what I had in the introduction. You know, as a journalist, this obvious hypocrisy of the double standard about how war is impacting civilians is just really driving me crazy. Our media talks about deaths in East Aleppo, but not Western Aleppo. We don't apply the same standard to the current U.S. campaigns in Mosul and Iraq, where our 2003 illegal invasion has already killed, by some estimates, more than 2 million people. And these standards of blame are not being applied to Yemen. We are also supplying Saudi Arabia and a very barbaric bombing campaign that has already killed or wounded at least 10,000 civilians. So what do you think is really happening in Aleppo? And we'll get to the other areas as well.
Well, with respect to Aleppo, there was a limited ceasefire agreement made by John Kerry, our Secretary of State, and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. They reached that accord on the 9th of September after excruciating sessions, give and take, compromise, and it went into effect on the 12th of September. And on the 17th of September, if my arithmetic is right, that's 5 days later, the U.S. Air Force took it upon itself to bomb known Syrian army positions, killing scores of Syrian soldiers, and pretty much scuttling the ceasefire. So the best attempts of Barack Obama and John Kerry to work out some kind of a tamping down of the violence has turned out to be all for naught. Why? Well, as some of the Russian leaders are now saying, it appears that the commander-in-chief's orders are not always obeyed by the Pentagon. Now, you know, on the face of it, that seems to be the case. And if the case, put yourself into Vladimir Putin's shoes. What does that mean? That means that he can't trust the president, even if the president is well-intentioned, because the president will be undercut by Secretary Carter of the Pentagon. And so you have a new President Carter, if you will. And Carter is just back from Brussels, where he bragged about sending U.S. brigades onto the border with Russia, with supervising the sending of other NATO troops.
You mean Ashcroft Carter.
Ashcroft Carter, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Ashton Carter, I guess.
Oh, Ashton Carter.
Ashcroft is the other criminal.
Okay.
So, you know, you have a situation here where the press, the Pentagon, And to a degree, the people who are in the State Department and the White House and will be there in spades under Hillary Clinton if she's elected, they're running the show. I don't know where Barack Obama is, actually. I haven't seen him around for a while. But the ideal solution here would be simply, as we veteran intelligence officers have suggested, would be for him simply to talk with Putin. See what's going on. See what Putin is afraid of. See why Putin might legitimately question whether the White House, the president himself, is really running the show. Now, you mentioned earlier on the brutality among police here in this country. I would point out that there's a direct correlation between what George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and the other criminals, and I use that word advisedly, these are war criminals. You know, we had a Second World War. I was alive during that time. I was real small, but I remember the aftermath of it, okay? Part of that aftermath was the Nuremberg Tribunal, and they didn't want this to happen again. And they said in a formal document, this is the definition of a war of aggression. It is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only in as much as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Now, accumulated evil, well, think torture. Think kidnapping, think black prisons, think about all the indignities we suffer here in this country by the curtailment of our human rights, our rights under the Constitution. Now, it's not as though our leaders were not warned. Colleen Rowley, the very courageous lawyer for the FBI, warned the head of the FBI in a open letter a month before the war, look, Mr. Director, Mr. FBI Director, this doctrine of preemptive, or worse still, preventive war, not only has no basis in international law, unless you're in imminent danger of attack, but it's going to come back to the streets of this United States of America, sure as you're sitting there, okay? And she warned about that. Now, what's the outcome of that? Well, many of the police who are doing these kinds of brutal acts are former veterans. Now, what have they been trained to do? Well, unfortunately, their experience in Afghanistan, Iraq, elsewhere, has trained them to be actually brutalized, dehumanized, to consider other people less than human. And as they look at the people ultimately responsible for all this, that is, you know, President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and the people who ran the torture prisons, nobody has been held accountable. And so, you know, it's not a big leap for our policemen on the beat to say, hey, if Bush is responsible for killing two million people, I mean, hey, I can pick off one or two myself. Now, this is really bad. And I just finished by giving you this reflection. The people who framed our Constitution were really, really foresighted. They embedded in that Constitution a provision for removing people like Bush and Cheney who did obviously criminal acts, not only international criminal acts, but monitoring all our telephones against the Fourth Amendment. That's called impeachment. Our founding fathers said, you know, every generation or so, a president's going to have to be impeached. I mean, it's just into human nature. They'll get too much power, and you have to impeach them. Now, in 2006, the House changed hands, and John Conyers became head of the Judiciary Committee. Now, if there was anyone that should be impeached for war crimes and others, it should have been George Bush and Dick Cheney. What happened? Well, Cindy Sheehan and I visited John Conyers. He said, well, are you going to impeach the president? And he said, no, I can't do that. We said, wait a second. You're chair now of the Judiciary Committee. What do you mean you can't do that? Hey, well, Nancy Pelosi says that we can't do that. So we said, Nancy Pelosi says that if we impeach the president, then we won't win as big in the next election because we'll seem divisive.
Yeah.
Whoa. And so that, there it is, folks. There was an orderly procedure to hold these people accountable.
But it wasn't taken.
Conyers kicked the ball down the road.
Well, Michael, the propaganda campaign that I'm talking about, and I have to really just call it that. It just seems that the news that we're getting is just that. And it feels to me like what we were bombarded with before the invasion of Iraq that Ray is talking about. And I remember, what was it called? Operation Iraqi Freedom or something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And it was this, it had its own brand and everything. And you know, I'm just wondering, what is the reaction, what's your reaction to what feels like another buildup to, you know, building a case for another conflict in the Middle East? And what's the reaction among the veterans you work with?
Oh, well, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for talking about this topic. I also want to say hello to Ray.
Hey, Michael.
yeah, he's on our advisory board, a longtime member of Veterans for Peace. So there's a lot to talk about here. First, I want to say, as far as what's going on in Iraq right now, Mosul, and we look at the invasion in 2003 as being the invasion that we talk about. But I'm a first, what they call the first Gulf War veteran. And the reality is that we've been in Iraq military operations wise since 1991. So we're really talking about 25 years of U.S. military operations of some sort, be it a ground invasion, which I participated mm-hmm. in, or no-fly zones, mm-hmm. Which were enforced by the U.S. and other Western powers. You know, when we supposedly left some years ago, we kept advisors there, and now we're so-called have advisors there now. But, you know, troops on the ground are troops on the ground. It doesn't matter if it's 10 or 100,000, it's still troops on the ground. So it's been 25 years. So the first thing I want to point out, and what is happening in that part of the country, in that part of the world right now, I would say that the U.S. is most responsible for the chaos and the deaths in Iraq after having been involved in that country for a quarter of a century. So then you ask about the propaganda. I think we need to always remember, and I think one of the debates when Hillary Clinton talked about the United States is good, if everyone remembers that she said we are good, and that's one of the reasons that we're great, that points directly to why whenever we're at war, not just currently, but in Vietnam or any military operation that takes place, is painted with the United States being the good guy, and of course whoever we attack is a bad guy. And we do that, of course, because we want to feel good about ourselves. So it's easy for the public to accept that kind of narrative. Because who wants to feel like we're doing bad things in the world? Who wants to feel like, you know, our country's not good? So our political leaders use that fact that we want to feel good about ourselves as a nation to paint a narrative that is certainly not fully truthful in order to for their objectives. So that's, I think, the major reason you're able to see people accepting this kind of propaganda and being readily accepted. And you're absolutely correct, especially when it comes to two places right now, Iraq, of course, so three. But when you look at Syria and Yemen and what the United States is doing in Syria and supporting in Syria. And of course, anytime you have the kind of bombings and military operations that we're participating in and supporting, you're going to have civilian deaths. And on the other side, the things they're doing, there's going to be civilian deaths. So there's war crimes on both sides. And we have a similar situation in Yemen where you mentioned 10,000
people, about 4,125 or so, what I saw in The Guardian, have been killed, and over 7,000 wounded. A third of those deaths are children, and 3.1 million people have been displaced, and 14 million people have food security issues. But none of that's talked about in the press, and certainly not the U.S. role in creating all of that.
You know, as you were talking, it also reminded me that this whole element about who we're supporting in Syria, because when the second wave of U.S. soldiers were sent into Iraq, not in your first Gulf War, but the second invasion in 2003, the whole issue was Al-Qaeda. And supposedly, and we know that Iraq didn't really have Al-Qaeda until we went in there and we kind of created a situation where we stirred up enough unrest and brought Al-Qaeda and those elements into that country. But what is the reaction to veterans to the fact that now in Syria, we're actually arming people who are connected with Al-Qaeda? And a lot of the weapons that we've either sent there or sent to Syria through other means, like through Saudi Arabia, have wound up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, the very people who we were supposedly fighting against 10 years ago.
Right. So I guess I should say, and I really didn't answer, I answered part of your question before. As far as Veterans for Peace's reaction to all of this, not just what's happening in Syria, but in Iraq, and our support in Yemen, and all the countries that you mentioned that were bombing, and also what's going on in Central Latin America. The United States is involved around the world trying to forge an objective of really domination. Of course, we're highly concerned, not only because we're a peace organization and we believe that there should be nonviolent ways to solve conflicts, but we also know that our political leaders and those who the leaders are forwarding these objectives, so for economic reasons, really don't care about, they don't care about people, and they don't care about the soldiers, the Navy personnel, Air Force, etc., that they send, the Marines, to do this fighting. We know that those who go to fight get the worst end of the deal, and those who send us to fight gain the most from it. So what will happen is more troops are sent. And if it's a small number, I mean, because they have special forces fighting in various places, so they keep a small footprint. But those people come back, and they come back with post-traumatic stress. They come back physically wounded. And many of them are not going to be able to function properly within society. And once again, these policies do not take any of that into account because they don't care about any of us. We all need to be clear. I think it's important for shows like this to try to help the public understand that these policies are not about keeping us safe. These policies are about foreigning agendas by a small group of people so that they can have political and economic control for their own greed.
I'm speaking to Michael McPherson, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace, and Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst turned political activist. And we are in the middle of this really fascinating discussion. I'm really, really thankful that these two gentlemen could join me this morning. But we're also in the middle of our fall membership drive. And I do have to kind of interrupt our talk right now to make an appeal to you to support, not just on the ground, because the money is not for us, but to support WPFW. This is your listener-powered Pacifica station in the nation's capital, the only place you're going to hear this discussion right now, as so many in this town are beating the drums of war. And as Ray McGovern just said, not even following the advice or the commands or the what is put forward by our own president. So if we have a rogue Pentagon, if we have a rogue element here basically doing what they want to do as opposed to what the commander in chief has dictated, then we have a real problem. And you're not really going to hear this anywhere else. You're going to hear more about Donald Trump groping women. You're going to hear more about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, but not in the way that we talk about the Clintons and their emails and the real fraud and corruption that really went on. So I need you to pick up the phone or go online to please make a pledge to keep WPFW on the air. We are going to celebrate our 40th anniversary in just 5 months or so. And that means that 40 years of allowing this type of discussion within the earshot of Halls of Power. 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739. Or you can pledge right online at WPFWFM.org. There's a red donate button on the upper left-hand corner, and you can click on that. And I really like the sustainer program. You can just donate $10 a month. I really would like to get those $20 a month, folks. That's just like less than 2 trips to Starbucks, right? Just $20 a month. And actually, if just 3 people did that, I would pretty much make my goal for today. So won't you be that one person? I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you, D.C., listening in D.C. You might be at your job or listening in Virginia or listening in Maryland, wherever you are. Annapolis, we need you. Arlington, we need you. We need you very badly. Southeast, Northeast D.C., Northwest. And if we are a part of the soundtrack for your life on Friday morning, we would love to know about that. This is our way of knowing that we are reaching you and making a difference. 202-588-9739 is the number to call, or pledge online at WPFWFM.org. We're going to go to a brief break right now, and we'll be right back. Yeah.
To me. Oh!
Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Ivarim, and I'm in conversation with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst turned political activist, and Michael McPherson, Army veteran from the first Gulf War and now executive director of Veterans for Peace. So we left off that discussion, and I think, Ray, you wanted to make a comment.
Pick up on your comment, Esther, about whether the Pentagon is obeying President Obama. I mean, it couldn't be anything more important than that, right? Okay. Well, it's very unusual. You know, I've been watching Soviet leadership now and Russian leadership for a half a century. I can tell you from my experience, very unusual for a leader of the Soviet Union and a foreign minister to talk openly about whether the president could be trusted or whether he's being undermined by his own military. But President Putin did precisely that yesterday. He was speaking, and I watched the speech. He was speaking at a discussion group called Valdai in Sochi, right on the Black Sea there. And he said, and I quote, my personal agreements with the President of the United States have been undermined, have not produced results. He went on to complain about, quote, people in Washington ready to do everything possible to prevent these agreements from being implemented in practice. Whoa, we know who he's referring to, right? And he's got a foreign minister who's the consummate diplomat who chooses his words very carefully. And this is Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister since, I guess, 2008. And what he said after the scuttling of the ceasefire, he said, quote, my good friend John Kerry, our Secretary of State, of course, is under fierce criticism from the U.S. military machine. Now, Kerry assured Putin personally that the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, President Barack Obama, supported what we did in our negotiations. But, as Lavrov adds, quote, apparently the military does not really listen to the Commander-in-Chief, period, end quote. Whoa. I've never seen that before. And there's more than just a kernel of truth. So what does that mean? Well, that means that when the Russians threw down the gauntlet, as they did, you know, after our Defense Department acted the way they did, the Ministry of Defense of Russia had their spokesman get up. And what he said was this. He said, look, you know, you talk about no-fly zones. Well, we got one we're putting in right now in Syria. We're going to shoot down anything. We'll shoot down anything that flies, okay? If it's unidentified, in other words, if it's not cleared ahead of time with us, we're going to shoot it down. And, you know, if you think that we can't shoot down stealth objects like stealth aircraft, well, you're in for a big surprise. Now, what's going to happen? Well, if I know the cowboys in the Air Force, they're pressing right now at the White House, say, hey, yeah, this is a good idea to just check out our stealth, see if the Russians really can shoot us down. And and Tuesday, the head of national intelligence himself, a former general in the Air Force, said, you know, I wouldn't put it past the Russians to shoot down one of the U.S. aircraft. Well, you know, offhandedly, they say these things. Don't they realize what the implications for escalation are? Don't they realize that the rest of us could all be fried if things are escalated to a nuclear level? I've never seen such disarray in Washington, and I have to say that when I look at how Putin and Lavrov are looking at this, I have to kind of understand that they must be shaking their heads and, more important, battening down the hatches and making sure that they fortify their own side of the border in Europe and in Syria.
Right, because NATO's been building up on Russia's border with heavy arms and actual soldiers?
That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, we made an agreement with the Russians that we wouldn't permanently station a lot of troops real, real close to the Russian border. So what we're doing here is we're putting in little brigades, and they're not going to be stationed there. They're going to rotate. But there'll always be a permanent rotation. you know. So this is sort of obeying the letter of the law and yet still having a permanent. Now, what do they intend to accomplish by this? Is there a threat from Russia? Well, you know, the bottom line here is, the answer is that when the Russian bear had his nose tweaked, namely on the 22nd of February 2014, when the U.S. and its Western allies mounted a coup on Russia's doorstep in Kiev. Now, this was a very unusual coup because it was advertised in advance. Okay, I've never seen the like of it. The Russians intercepted a message between our Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs and our ambassador in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. And what did the message say? Victoria Nuland, we've got it glued, Ambassador Pyatt. We've got it glued. Yats is the guy we're going to put in. It's all fixed up. just to make sure that Klitschko and the other guys wait in the background. We're going to go ahead with this. Okay. Now, when was that put on YouTube? First couple of days of February 2014. What happens on the 22nd of February? There's a coup. And who's the new prime minister? Yats. His name is Yatsenyuk, okay? Mm-hmm. And how long did it take us to recognize that government? 2 hours? So, George Friedman from Stratfor, the think tank, very candidly called that the most blatant coup in the history of mankind, which it was. Now, that was on the 22nd of February. Now, modern European history for the Pentagon starts when? On the 23rd. You never hear about the coup. All you hear about is Russia's concern about its only warm water military port, naval port in Crimea, and you never hear that the Crimeans voted to rejoin Russia, but they did. So right. That's where it all starts. That's where people say, aha, look at how the Russians are aggressors and how they invaded Crimea, which they did not. They already had 20,000 people in there under a bilateral agreement with Ukraine. And how they invaded eastern Ukraine, they didn't do that either, although they are supporting the people who are anti-coup there. So it's a mess. But Obama does not seem to be able to be, be a real commander-in-chief and put a brake on this rabble-rising. The last thing I'll say is this, that none other than the German foreign minister, our ally, his name is Steinmeier. Late last spring, he criticized NATO for saber-rattling. And he said, this is not the way to conduct relief. This can just be a pretext to bring back the Cold War. That's Steinmeier. So there are people in Europe who realize this, but very few in Washington.
Well, I also want to, we're kind of running short on time. Our less than an hour goes by really fast. Before we go, though, Ray, and I want to bring you back in, Michael, also. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Before you ask the question, there's three things I wanted to address real quick, and mm-hmm. I'll be real fast. So the first one is when Ray talks about how the media is talking about what's happening in Ukraine and Crimea and with the U.S. And I just wanted to point out once again, as he said, where the story begins with what they're painting as U.S. aggression, not U.S. aggression, Russian aggression, but not talking about what the U.S. has done leading up to this Russian pushback. So it gets back once again to the idea that the U.S. is good, that we are standing up to aggression. So that will always be a theme in the propaganda. Mm. And one reason is because that's important for the American psyche, for U.S. people's psyche to believe that, and people are ready to believe that. So we have to work on ways to show that America, the United States, is not always good. We do good things, but we're not always good. We do bad things as well. As far as Obama and the Defense Department, we must hold President Obama, and as a person, I like President Obama and his family. But when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, and if he is not controlling the Defense Department, that is his fault. He is the president of the United States, and it is essential that there is civilian control of the military. That's important to our democracy. So if he is not in a struggle, and if it needs to be open in order to get the Pentagon under control, which means if he needs to fire Ashton Carter, or if he needs to fire some generals, whatever he needs to do to get them under control, he needs to do that, because that is essential to our democracy. And then the last thing, as far as veterans and law enforcement, Ray brought that up, and we might have a little bit of a different take on it. Number one, I'm not exactly sure how many vets have really joined law enforcement. Of course, some have, but I don't know to what extent, and I haven't seen a lot of statistics on that, or how vets act as opposed to people who haven't been in combat. But when it comes to the shootings, we need to be clear. It is racism. The reason for the shootings, how black bodies have been looked at in this country for centuries, and how our society, veteran or not, how white supremacy treats black people, which is what needs to be changed. This is the reason that we see this disproportionate number of shootings.
Okay, thank you. No, we have, we are pretty much out of time.
I'm sorry.
But no. Thank you. No, thank
you. I just
you.
Want to register my agreement with all the things that Michael just said.
Right. So, and thank you. Thank you, Michael. No, I don't apologize at all. We need more time, but we are trying to work within the time we have. And that will actually have to do it for us today on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. A special thanks to my guests, Ray McGovern and Michael McPherson. Thanks to Chantel James. For her reporting at the University of Maryland. And thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and our past shows. This today's show will be archived there. Please like our Facebook and our Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
That was really nice.